Dusk. Huge stripes of day-glow green and orange ran up the soaring redwoods and gleamed out at dusk, as if nature had said at last, "Ah, freak it," and had freaked out. Up the gully back of the house, up past the hermit's cave, were day-glow face masks and boxes and machines and things that glowed, winked, hummed, whistled, bellowed, and microphones that could pick up animals, hermits, anything, and broadcast them from the treetops, like the crazy gibbering rhesus background noises from the old Jungle Gym radio shows. Dusk. At dusk a man could put on something like a World War I aviator's leather helmet, only painted in screaming day-glow, and with his face painted in day-glow constellations, the bear, the goat, a great walking day-glow hero in the dusky, rusky forests, and he could orate in the deep of the forest up the hill, only in spectral tones, like the shadow, any old message, something like, "This is Control Tower, this is Control Tower. Clear runway 1, the cougar microbes approach, bleeding antique lint from every pore and begging for high octane. Beware, be aware, all ye who sleep in barracks on the main strip, the lumps in your mattress are carnivore spores, venereal butterflies sent by the combine to moth-proof your brain, a pro kit in every light socket. Plug up the light sockets. The cougar microbes are marching in like army ants." Happy to know that someone, somebody, might answer from the house or someplace over another microphone booming over the La Honda Hills. "Mayday, mayday, collapse the poles at every joint, hide inside your folding rulers, calibrate your brains for the head count." And Bob Dylan raunched and roomed away in the sphenoids or some damned place. By nightfall, the pranksters are in the house and a few joints are circulating, saliva, liva, 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 and the whole thing is getting deeper into the moment, as it were. And people are working on tapes, tapes being played back, stopped, rewound, played again. A click on the plastic lever, stopped again. And a little speed making the rounds, such a lordly surge under the redwoods, tablets of benzedrine and dexedrine mainly. And you take off for a burst of work and rapping into the night. Experiments of all sorts favored here, like putting contact microphones up against the bare belly and listening to the enzymes gurgling. Most prankster bellies go gurgle galump blub and so on, but Cassidy's goes ping, ding-a-ping, ting, as if he were wired at 78 RPM and everyone else is at 33 RPM, which seems about right. And then they play a tape against a television show. That is, they turn on the picture on the TV, the Ed Sullivan Show, say, but they turn off the sound and play a tape of, say, Babs and somebody rapping off each other's words. The picture of the Ed Sullivan Show and the words on the tape suddenly force your mind to reach for connections between two vastly different orders of experience. On the TV screen, Ed Sullivan is holding Ella Fitzgerald's hands with his hands, sopped over her hands, as if her hands were the first robins of spring, and his lips are moving, probably saying, "Ella, that was wonderful, really wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, another hand for a great, great lady." But the voice that comes out is saying to Ella Fitzgerald, in perfect sync, "The lumps in your mattress are carnivore spores, venereal butterflies sent by the combine to moth-proof your brain, a pro kit in every light socket. Ladies and gentlemen, plug up the light sockets, plug up the light sockets. The cougar microbes are marching in." Perfect. The true message. Although this kind of weird synchronization usually struck outsiders as mere coincidence or just whimsical, meaningless in any case. They couldn't understand why the pranksters grooved on it so. The inevitable confusion of the unattuned, like most of the pranksters' unique practices, it derived from the LSD experience and was incomprehensible without it. Under LSD, if it really went right, ego and non-ego started to merge. Countless things that seemed separate started to merge, too. A sound became a color. Blue colors became smells. Walls began to breathe like the underside of a leaf with one's own breath. A curtain became a column of concrete, and yet it began rippling, this incredible concrete mass rippling in harmonic waves like the Puget Sound bridge before the crash, and you can feel it. The entire harmonics of the universe, from the most massive to the smallest and most personal, presque vue, all flowing together in this very moment. This side of the LSD experience, the feeling, tied in with Young's theory of synchronicity. Young tried to explain the meaningful coincidences that occur in life and cannot be explained by cause-and-effect reasoning, such as ESP phenomena. He put forth the hypothesis that the unconscious perceives certain archetypal patterns that elude the conscious mind. These patterns, he suggested, are what unite subjective or psychic events with objective phenomena, the ego with the non-ego, as in psychosomatic medicine, or in the microphysical events of modern physics, in which the eye of the beholder becomes an integral part of the experiment. Countless philosophers, prophets, early scientists, not to mention alchemists and occultists, had tried to present the same idea in the past. Plotinus, Lao Tzu, Pico della Mirandola, Agrippa, Kepler, Leibniz. Every phenomenon and every person is a microcosm of the whole pattern of the universe, according to this idea. It is as if each man were an atom in a molecule in a fingernail of a giant being. Most men spend their lives trying to understand the workings of the molecule they're born into, and all they know for sure are the cause and effect workings of the atoms in it. A few brilliant men grasp the structure of the entire fingernail. A few geniuses, like Einstein, may even see that they're all part of a finger of some sort. So, space equals time. All the while, however, many men get an occasional glimpse of another fingernail from another finger flashing by, or even a whole finger, or even the surface of the giant being's face, and they realize instinctively that this is a part of a pattern they are all involved in, although they are totally powerless to explain it by cause and effect. And then, some visionary, through some accident, Mahavira, through some quirk of metabolism, through some drug perhaps, as his doors of perception opened for an instant, and he almost sees, presque vu, the entire being, and he knows for the first time that there is a whole other pattern here. Each moment in his life is only minutely related to the cause and effect chain within his little molecular world. Each moment, if he could only analyze it, reveals the entire pattern of the motion of the giant being, and his life is minutely synced in with it. And when the Chevron tanker follows the bus into nowhere, one gets a glimpse of the pattern, a new level. Many levels here. The pranksters never talked about synchronicity by name, but they were more and more attuned to the principle. Obviously, according to this principle, man does not have free will. There is no use in his indulging in a lifelong competition to change the structure of the little environment he seems to be trapped in. But one could see the larger pattern and move with it, go with the flow, and accept it and rise above one's immediate environment, and even alter it by accepting the larger pattern and grooving with it. Put your good where it will do the most. Gradually, the prankster attitude began to involve the main things religious mystics have always felt, things common to Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, and, for that matter, theosophists, and even flying saucer cultists. Namely, the experiencing of another world, a higher level of reality, and a perception of the cosmic unity of this higher level, and the feeling of timelessness, the feeling that what we know as time is only the result of a naive faith in causality, the notion that A in the past caused B in the present, which will cause C in the future, when actually A, B, and C are all part of a pattern that can be truly understood only by opening the doors of perception and experiencing it in this moment, this supreme moment, this kairos. For a long time, I couldn't understand the one oriental practice the pranksters liked, the throwing of the I Ching coins. The I Ching is an ancient Chinese text, the Book of Changes it is called. It contains 64 oracular readings, all highly metaphorical. You ask the I Ching a question and throw 3 coins 3 times and come up with a hexagram and a number that points to one of the passages. It answers your question. Yes, but the I Ching didn't seem very prankster-like. I couldn't fit it in with the prankster's wired-up American flag-flying day-glow electro-pastel surge down the Great American Superhighway. Yet, of course, the I Ching was supremely the book of now, of the moment. For, as Jung said, the way the coins fall is inevitably tied up with the quality of the entire moment in which they fall, the entire pattern and form a part of it, a part that is insignificant to us, yet most meaningful to Chinese minds. These things that only lucky dogs and merry pranksters hear. And so many mysteries of the sink from that time on. There is another book on the shelf in Kesey's living room that everybody seems to look at, a little book called The Journey to the East by Hermann Hesse. Hesse wrote it in 1932, and yet, The Sink, it is a book about exactly the pranksters and the great bus trip of 1964. It was my destiny to join in a great experience, the book began. Having had the good fortune to belong to the League, I was permitted to be a participant in a unique journey. It goes on to tell about a weird, circuitous journey across Europe, toward the east, that the members of this league took. It began, supposedly, with unclassifiable meaning. My happiness did indeed a profound, great American super surge down the electropasta flying day-glow-eyes from the same secret as the happiness in dreams. It arose from the freedom to experience everything imaginable simultaneously, to exchange outward and inward easily, to move time and space about like scenes in a theater. And as we League brothers traveled throughout the world without motor cars or ships, as we conquered the war-shattered world by our faith and transformed it into paradise, we creatively brought the past, the future, and the fictitious into the present moment. The present moment. Now, the Kairos. It was like the man had been on acid himself and was on the bus. Every Friday night they held a briefing. Briefing was Bab's term from his military days in Vietnam. Fay fixes some supper of rice and beans and meat, kind of a stew, and they all go into the kitchen and dig into the pots and put some on a plate and eat. A few joints are circulating around, saliva, liva, liva, liva. Then they all go up to one of the tents on the plateau, Pages, and they all crowd in there, sitting this way and that with their legs pulled up under their chins, and they start throwing out this and that subject for discussion. Curiously, this is like summer camp on one level, the Honor Council meeting out in the woods after supper, everything smelling of charred firewood and canvas damp with dew, and crickets and cicadas sounding off, and people slapping their ankles from mosquitoes and bugs and shit. On the other hand, the smell of new-mown grass burning and the many levels aren't particularly summer camp. They usually wait for Kesey to start off. He usually starts off with something specific, something he's seen, something he's been doing, and builds up to what he's been thinking. He starts talking about the lag systems he is trying to work out with tape recorders. Out in the back house, he has variable lag systems in which a microphone broadcasts over a speaker, and in front of the speaker is a second microphone. This microphone picks up what you just broadcast, but an instant later. If you wear earphones from the second speaker, you can play off against the sound of what you've just said as in an echo. Or you can do the thing with tapes, running the tape over the sound heads of two machines before it's wound on the take-up reel. Or you can use three microphones and three speakers, four tape recorders and four sound heads, and on until you get a total sense of the lag. A person has all sorts of lags built into him, Kesey is saying. One, the most basic, is the sensory lag, the lag between the time your senses receive something and you are able to react. 1/30th of a second is the time it takes if you're the most alert person alive, and most people are a lot slower than that. Now, Cassidy is right up against that 1/30th of a second barrier. He is going as fast as a human can go, but even he can't overcome it. He is a living example of how close you can come, but it can't be done. You can't go any faster than that. You can't, through sheer speed, overcome the lag. We are all of us doomed to spend our lives watching a movie of our lives. We are always acting on what has just finished happening. It happened at least 1/30th of a second ago. We think we're in the present, but we aren't. The present we know is only a movie of the past, and we will really never be able to control the present through ordinary means. That lag has to be overcome some other way, through some kind of total breakthrough. And there are all sorts of other lags besides that go along with it. There are historical and social lags, where people are living by what their ancestors or somebody else perceived. and they may be 25 or 50 years or centuries behind, and nobody can be creative without overcoming all those lags first of all. A person can overcome that much through intellect or theory or study of history and so forth, and get pretty much into the present that way. But he's still going to be up against one of the worst lags of all, the psychological. Your emotions remain behind because of training, education, the way you were brought up, blocks, hang-ups, and stuff like that. And as a result, your mind wants to go one way, but your emotions don't. Cassidy speaks up. Blue noses, red eyes, and that's all there is to say about that. And, for once, he stops right there. But, of course, the whole emotional lag, and Cassidy, voluble King Vulcan himself, has suddenly put it all into one immediate image, like a Zen poem or an early Pound poem. Hot little animal red eyes bottled up by cold little blue nose hang-ups. Cassidy's disciple, Bradley, says, God is red, and even he stops right there. The son of a bitch is on for once. It is all compacted into those three words, even shorter than Cassidy's line. Like Bradley didn't even have to think it out, it just came out. A play on the phrase, God is dead, only saying, for those of us onto the analogical thing, God is not dead, God is red. God is the bottled-up red animal inside all of us, whole, all-feeling, complete, out front. Only it is made dead by all the lags. Keezy giggles slightly and says, I think maybe we're really synced up tonight. Somebody starts talking about some kid they know who has been busted for possession of grass. And the cop said something to him, and he said something back, and the cop started beating on him. Everybody commiserates with the poor incarcerated bastard, and they comment on the unfortunate tendency cops have of beating up on people, and Babs says, Yeah, yeah, right, 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 but that's in his movie. In his movie, right, 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 and they all grok over that. Grok. And then it's clear, without anybody having to say it. Everybody, everybody everywhere, has his own movie going, his own scenario. And everybody is acting his movie out like mad. Only most people don't know that is what they're trapped by, their little script. Everybody looks around inside the tent and nobody says it out loud because nobody has to. Yet everybody knows at once. Somehow this ties in, syncs directly with what Kesey has just said about the movie screen of our perceptions that closes us out from our own reality. And somehow syncs directly at the same time in this very moment with the actual physical movie, the movie, that they have been slaving over. The great morass of a movie, with miles and miles of spiraling spliced over film and hot splices billowing around them like so many intertwined, synced, but still chaotic and struggling human lives, theirs, the whole fucking world, in this very moment. Cassidy in his movie called Speed Limit, he is both a head whose thing is speed, meaning amphetamines, and a unique being whose quest is speed, faster, goddammit, spiraling, jerking, kicking, fibrillating, tight up against the 1/30th of a second movie screen barrier of our senses, trying to get into now. Mountain Girl's movie is called Big Girl, and her scenario stars a girl who grew up being the big, surging, powerful girl in genteel surroundings. Oh, fantasy Ecla, Poughkeepsie, New York. Oh, Vassar scholars, and who didn't fit into whatever they had in mind for delicate girls in striped seersucker jumpers, in faint ratcheting water sprinkler sun jewels on the water drops, on the green grass Poughkeepsie. A big girl who's got to break out and she gets good and loud and brassy to come on stronger in this unequal contest. And later in the plot, finds out she is bigger in quite another way, and bright and beautiful. One looks around, and one sees the hermit huddled up here inside the tent. Hermit, whom all love, but he gets on nerves. Why? And they say, fuck off, hermit, after which they regret it, and his movie is called Everybody's Bad Trip. He is everybody's bad trip. He takes it upon himself. He takes your bad trip for you, the worst way you thought it could happen. And Page, with his black jacket with the iron cross on it, his movie is called, of course, Zealot. It is as if everyone in here, smelling the burning grass, suddenly remembers a dream Page told them he had while he was sleeping on a cot in a jail in Arizona for, turning the citizens on to dimensional cremo. Yes, well. In this dream, a young man named Zealot came to town, dressed in black. and he inflamed the citizens into doing all the secret fiend things they most dreaded letting themselves do, like staving in the windows of the Fat Jewelry Company Incorporated, and scooping it up, like jumping little high-assed mulatto wenches, doing all the forbidden things, led on, encouraged, onward, upward, by the burning, shiny black horseman Zealot. After which, in the freaking cold blue morning after, they all look at each other. Who did this? Who did all this dope-taking and looting and shafting? What in the name of God came over us? What came over this town? Well, shit, it wasn't us, it was him. He infected and inflamed our brains, that damned snake, Zealot. And they charged down the street alternately beating their breasts and their bald heads, yelling for the hide of Zealot, crying out his name as the ultimate infamy. While Zealot just rides off nonchalantly into the black noon, and they just have to watch his black back and the black ass of his horse receding over the next hill, taking the crusade on to turn on the next town. Yes. Yeah, we're really synced up tonight. And, of course, everyone in this tent looks at Kesey and wonders. What is his movie? Well, you might call it Randall McMurphy for a start. McMurphy, goading, coaxing, leading everybody on to give themselves a little bigger movie, a little action, moving the plot from out of dead-ass Snug Harbor. There's a hell of a scene going for you, bub, out here in Edge City, but don't even stop there. And all those things are keeping us out of the present, Kesey is saying, out of our own world, our own reality. And until we can get into our own world, we can't control it. If you ever make that breakthrough, you'll know it. It'll be like you had a player piano, and it is playing a mile a minute, with all the keys sinking in front of you in fantastic chords, and you never heard of the song before, but you are so far into the thing, your hands start going along with it exactly. When you make that breakthrough, then you will start controlling the piano, and extend the message to all people. Chapter 12. The Bust. Whereas La Honda's Wild West load seems to be owed to the gunslinging younger brothers, and whereas they hold up in town and dad blamed but they found a neighborly way to pay for their stay, and whereas they built a whole wooden store, those notorious mothers, but them was the younger brothers, mere gunslingers, and whereas now this Kesey and his merry humdingers down the road, goddamn Wild West obscene crazies and dope fiends and putrescent beatniks, paint the tree trunks phosphorescent. And whereas they beat on tin drums with sticks and roots, while a tin man with a tin tenderloin buries his smile in the tin groin of a tin bitch ejaculating through a bunion, and whereas the crazies go cooing, keening, itchy-gooning, ululating, and yahooing, worse than gunslingers, and whereas we know what the ninnies are doing, you are hereby empowered. By now the pranksters had built up so much momentum they began to feel immune even to a very obvious danger, namely the cops. The citizens of La Honda were becoming more and more exercised about Kesey and the pranksters, and so were the San Mateo County Sheriff and federal narcotics officials. Not knowing what the hell accounted for the crazy life at Kesey's place, they apparently assumed there was some hard drug use going on. Heroin, cocaine, morphine. Late in 1964, they put Kesey's place under surveillance. The pranksters knew about it and used to play games with the cops. The main federal narcotics agent in the area was a San Francisco Chinese, Agent William Wong. The pranksters made a huge sign and put it up on the house. We're clean, Willie! It was fun, the cop game. The cops would be out in the woods at night along the creek, and one of them would step into the creek and get his feet wet and say something. The pranksters would pick all this up on the remote mics in the woods, whereupon the voice of Mountain Girl, broadcasting from inside the cabin, would jeer out over an amplifier up in the redwoods, Hey, why don't you come in the house and dry off your feet, you cops? Quit playing the cop game and come in and get some nice hot coffee. The cops were just playing their eternal cop game. That's all it seemed like to the pranksters. About April 21st, 1965, the pranksters got a tip that a warrant had been drawn up and the cops were going to raid. Delightful. The cops were really going to play their game right up to their BB gun eyeballs. The pranksters put up a great sign at the front gate. No admittance. 5-day countdown in progress, as if they were embarked upon the damnedest, most awfulest dope orgy brain blowout in the history of the world. In fact, they set about making the premises clean. On the 3rd day of the countdown, April 23rd, 1965, 10:50 p.m., the raid came. Oh, God, there was never a better game played by any cops. Here they were, the absolute perfect cop game cops, the sheriff, 17 deputies, Federal Agent Wong, 8 police dogs, cars, wagons, guns, posses, ropes, walkie-talkies, bullhorns, Cosmo, the whole freaking raid scene. And right up to the end, the pranksters played it as they saw it, namely as a high farce, an opera bouffe. The cops claimed they caught Kesey trying to flush a batch of marijuana down the toilet. Kesey claimed he was only in there painting flowers on the toilet bowl. The bathroom was already a madhouse collage of photos, clippings, murals, mandalas, every weird thing in the world, like an indoor version of the bus, and the cops crashed in and Agent Wong grabbed Kesey from behind. Kesey was later booked on a charge of resisting arrest, among other charges, to which he said that he had been in the bathroom and some unidentified male came up and embraced him from behind, and so naturally he slugged him. It was a laugh and a half. Kesey's resistance, he said, upended Wong and hurtled him into the bathtub on top of Paige Browning, who was taking a bath. Browning was arrested for resisting arrest, too. It was too much. Even after the raiders had everybody in there, 13 people lined up against the walls and were searching them for drugs, it was just the most whacked-out cop game anybody had ever seen any cops play. One of the raiders reached into Mike Hagan's pocket, and when he drew his hand out, it held a vial of some clear liquid, whereupon all the pranksters started shouting, "Hey, play fair, be fair cops, play hard but play fair," and so on. The vial, whatever it was or was supposed to be, was never heard of again. In a toolbox outside, the raiders found a hypodermic syringe full of some kind of liquid, which turned out to be 3-in-1 oil for oiling the tape recorder mechanisms. And Kesey and 12 others, including Babs, Gretch, Hagen, Walker, Mountain Girl, Paige, Cassidy, and the Hermit, were booked on many charges, including possession of marijuana and narcotics paraphernalia, the syringe, resisting arrest and impairing the morals of minors, Mountain Girl and the Hermit. Even then, the whole thing became not much more than the cop and jailhouse and judge and lawyer game, with such high moments as when they all got bailed out and emerged from the jail in San Mateo and the Hermit's mother appeared. Hermit, they discovered from the police blotter, was named Anthony Dean Wells. Nobody had ever asked him what his name was. Anyway, his mother slapped Kesey across the face with a paperback edition of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and screamed, "Go back to your cuckoo pad. You should have stayed in the nest instead of flying over it, you big cuckoo." Well, the whole thing was too much. When the cops booked them, Babs gave his occupation as movie producer, and Mountain Girl said she was a movie technician. So Babs solemnly appeared in the local newspapers as the big movie producer, caught in the raid along with the big novelist, Kesey. It was something. The San Francisco newspapers took a very lively interest in the case and sent people out to interview Kesey within the dope den, and word of the prankster lifestyle was made public, however obliquely, for the first time. The publicity couldn't have been better, at least in terms of the hip intellectual circles where the pranksters might hope to have some immediate influence. Accusing somebody of possession of marijuana was like saying, "I saw him take a drink." Kesey was referred to as a kind of hipster Christ, a modern mystic, after the model of Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs. As all could plainly read in the press, Kesey had gone even further. He had stopped writing. He was now working on a vast experimental movie entitled, the newspapers solemnly reported, "Intrepid Traveler and His Merry Pranksters Leave in Search of a Cool Place." "Writers," he told a reporter, "are trapped by artificial rules. We are trapped in syntax. We are ruled by an imaginary teacher with a red ballpoint pen who will brand us with an A- for the slightest infraction of the rules. Even cuckoo seems like an elaborate commercial." LSD was never mentioned in all this. Kesey came off chiefly as a visionary who had forsaken his riches and his career as a novelist in order to explore new forms of expression. In the California press, he graduated from mere literary fame to celebrity. If the purpose of the raid was to stamp out dopeniks, The cop game couldn't have backfired more completely. After Kesey and the pranksters got out on bail, the legal wrangling went on interminably, but they all stayed free. Kesey had a team of aggressive, bright young lawyers working on the case, Zonker's brother-in-law, Paul Robertson, in San Jose, and Pat Hallinan and Brian Rowan from San Francisco. Hallinan was the son of Vincent Hallinan, the lawyer, a famous champion of the underdog. By and by, the charges were dropped against everybody but Kesey and Paige Browning, and even they ended up with only one charge lodged against them, possession of marijuana. They trooped down to Redwood City, the San Mateo County seat, 15 times during the last 8 months of 1965, by Rowan's count. It was interminable, but they all stayed free. Yes, and heads, kids, kooks, intellectual tourists of all kinds started heading for Kesey's in La Honda. Even Sandy Lehman Haupt returned. About a year had gone by, and he was okay again, and he flew into San Francisco. Kesey and four or five other pranksters drove to the San Francisco airport to meet him. As they drove back to La Honda, Sandy cheerfully gave a brief account of what had happened to him and Big Sur before he split like he did. "Then I started having dream wars with somebody," said Sandy. He didn't want to say who. "Yeah, I know," said Kesey, "with me." He knew. And the misto fogs began to roll in again off the bay. Norman Hartwig and his friend Evan Engberg drove up to La Honda from Los Angeles with the idea of doing the Tibetan thing for a few weeks and seeing what it was all about. That was pretty funny, the idea of doing the Tibetan thing at Kesey's. Nevertheless, it was Norman's idea. Norman was a 27-year-old playwright from Ann Arbor, Michigan. He was a thin guy, 5'7", with a thin face and sharp features and a beard. But his nose tilted up slightly, which gave him a boyish look. He was eking out a living by writing a column for the Los Angeles Free Press, a weekly, the L.A. counterpart of the Village Voice, and working on avant-garde films, and living in a room underneath the dance floor of a discotheque on the Sunset Strip. He had run into Kesey's friend Susan Brustman, and then into Kesey himself, and Kesey had invited him up to La Honda to edit the movie and partake of the life. Somehow Norman got the idea the people at Kesey's were like, you know, monks, novitiates. A lot of meditating with your legs crossed, chanting, eating rice, feeling vibrations, walking softly over the forest floor and thinking big. Why else would they be out in the woods in the middle of nowhere? So Norman drove up from L.A. with Evan Engber, who was a theater director, occasionally, and later a member of Dr. West's jug band, and, as a matter of fact, the husband of Yvette Mimieux, the movie actress. They drove up the coastal route, California Route 1, then cut over Route 84 at San Gregorio and on up into the Redwood Forests, around a bend, and there at Kesey's. But Jesus, somehow it doesn't look very Tibetan. It isn't the hanged man in the tree so much, or the statue of a guy eating it. Hell, there are no flies on the Tibetans. It is more the odd detail here and there. Kesey's mailbox, for example, which is red, white, and blue, the stars and stripes. And a big framed sign on top of the house. We was framed. And the front gate across the wooden bridge. The gate is made of huge woodcutter's saw blades and has a death mask on it. And a big sign about 15 feet long that reads, "The Merry Pranksters Welcome the Hell's Angels." Music is blasting out of some speakers on top of the house, a Beatles record. "Help! I need somebody!" At that moment, that very moment, Engberg gets a stabbing pain in his left shoulder. "I don't know what it is, Norman," he says, "but it's killing me." They drive on in across the bridge and get out and go into the house looking for Kesey. Brown dogs belly through the flea clouds outside the house, coughing fruit flies. Engberg clutches his shoulder. Inside, bright green and gold light streams in through the French doors onto the damnedest clutter. There are big pipes hanging down from the rafters in the main room, a whole row of them, like some enormous vertical xylophone. Also dolls, dolls hanging from the rafters, reassembled dolls, dolls with the head sticking out of a hip joint, a leg out of the neck joint, arm out of the other leg joint, leg out of shoulder joint, and so on, and a day-glow navel. Also balloons, also Chianti bottles stuck on the rafters at weird angles somehow, as if they had been in the very process of falling to the floor and suddenly they froze there. And on the floor, on chairs, on tables, on the couch, toys and tape recorders, and pieces of tape recorders, and pieces of tape recorders, and movie equipment, and pieces of pieces of movie equipment, and tapes and film running all over the place, plated in among wires and sockets, all of it in great spiral tangles, great celluloid billows, and a big piece of a newspaper headline cut out and stuck up on the wall. Hail to all edges. In the midst of all this, sitting toward the side, is a gangling girl, looks very Scandinavian, idling over a guitar, which she can't play, and she looks up at Norman and says, "We've all got hang-ups, and we've got to get rid of them." "Yeah, yeah, I guess that's right." There, on the other side here, is a little figure with an enormous black beard. The little gnome looks up at Norman. His eyes narrow, and he breaks into a vast, inexplicable grin, looking straight at Norman and then Angber. And then he goes scuttling out the door, snuffling and giggling to himself. "Yeah, yeah, I guess that's right, too." "I don't know what the hell has happened to me," says Angber, clutching his shoulder, "but it's getting worse." Norman keeps walking back through the house until he hits a bathroom. Only it is a madhouse of a bathroom. The walls, the ceilings, everything, one vast collage, lurid splashes of red and orange, lurid ads and lurid color photos from out of magazines, pieces of plastic, cloth, paper, streaks of Day-Glo paint, and from the ceiling and down one wall a wild, diagonal romp of rhinoceroses, like a thousand tiny rhinoceroses chasing each other through crazy lurid land. Over the top part of the mirror, over the sink, is a small death mask painted in Day-Glo. The mask hangs from a hinge. Norman lifts it up, and underneath the mask is a typewritten message pasted on the mirror. "Now that I've got your attention..." Norman and Angber go out back and head up the path that leads into the woods to look for Kesey. Up past screaming Day-Glo tree trunks and tents here and there, and some kind of weird cave down in a gully with Day-Glo objects glowing in the mouth of it, and then into deep green glades under the redwoods with the limelight filtering through. And they keep coming upon weird objects. Suddenly a whole bed, an old-fashioned iron bedstead, a mattress, a cover, but all glowing with mad stripes and swirls of orange, red, green, yellow Day-Glo. Then a crazed toy horse in a tree trunk. Then a telephone. A telephone sitting up on a tree stump, glowing in the greeny deeps with beautiful glowing cords of many colors coming out of it. Then a TV set, only with mad Day-Glo designs painted on the screen. Then into a clearing, a flash of sunlight, and down the slope here comes Kesey. He looks twice as big as the time Norman saw him in L.A. He has on white Levi's and a white T-shirt. He walks very erect, and his huge muscled arms swing loose. The redwoods soar all around. Norman says, "Hello." But Kesey just nods slightly and smiles very faintly, as if to say, "You said you'd be here, and here you are." Kesey looks around, and then down the slope toward the tent plateaus and the house and the highway, and says, "We're working on many levels here." Angber clutches his shoulder and says, "I don't know what this thing is, Norman, but it's killing me. I've got to go back to L.A. "Well, okay, Evan. I'll come back up when I get over it." Norman kind of knew he wouldn't, and he didn't, but Norman wanted to stick around. "All right, film editor, article writer, participant, observer, you're here. On with your editing, writing, observing." But somehow Norman doesn't start cutting film or writing his column. Almost immediately, the strange atmosphere of the place starts rolling over him. There is an atmosphere of, how can one describe it? We are all onto something here, or into something, but no one is going to put it into words for you. Put it into words. One trouble right away is that he finds it very hard to get into the conversations here in the house in the woods. Everyone is very friendly, and most of them are outgoing. But they are all talking about, how can one describe it, about life, things that are happening around there, things they are doing, or about things of such an abstract and metaphorical nature that he can't fasten onto them either. Then he realizes that what it really is that they are interested in none of the common intellectual currency that makes up the conversations of intellectuals in hip L.A. The standard topics, books, movies, new political movements. For years he and all his friends have been talking about nothing but intellectual products, ideas, concoctions, brain candy, shadows of life, as a substitute for living. Yes, they don't even use the usual intellectual words here. Mostly it is just thing. Cassidy's thing is, Christ Almighty, Cassidy, and it is with Cassidy that he gets the first sense of the daily allegory at Kesey's. Allegorical living, every action a demonstration of a lesson of life, like Cassidy's gestalt driving. But that is your term. Whenever there is any driving to be done, Cassidy does it. That is Cassidy's thing, or his thing on one level. They drive up the mountain, up to Skylanda, atop Cahill Ridge for something. Coming back down the mountain, Norman is in the back seat, two or three others are sitting front and back, and Cassidy is driving. They start hauling down the mountain, faster and faster, the trees snapping by like in some kind of amusement park ride, only Cassidy isn't looking at the road, or holding onto the wheel. His right hand is flipping the dial on the radio. One rock and roll number blips out here. I'm nerding at noon erlation. Then another one here on the dial. Vron, baby sucku pon pon. All the time Cassidy is whamming out the beat on the steering wheel with the heel of his left hand, and the whole car seems to be shuddering with it, and his head is turned completely around looking Norman squarely in the eye, and grinning as if he is having the most congenial, delightful conversation with him. Only Cassidy is doing all the talking, an incredible oral fibrillation of words, nutty nostalgia. A 46 Plymouth, you understand, gear shift like a Dairy Queen pulled upside a 47 Chrysler, jumpy little marshmallow fellow in there, had a kickdown gear, was gonna ossify the world, you understand. All to Norman with the happiest smile in the world. You crazy fool, the truck! At the last possible moment, somehow Cassidy fishtails the car back onto the inside of the curve, and the truck shoots by clean black shot like a great 10-ton highballing teardrop of tar. Cassidy still talking, banging on the steering wheel, pounding and rapping away. Norman, terrified. Norman looks at the others to see if... But they're all sitting there throughout the whole maniacal ride as if nothing out of the ordinary has happened at all. And maybe that's it. The first onset of ahor paranoia hits. Maybe that's it. Maybe he has been sucked into some incredible trap by a bunch of dope-taking crazies who are going to toy with him, for what reason I do not... Back at the house, he decides to get into his role of journalist, reporter, observer. At least he will be doing something and be outside, sane, detached. He starts asking about this and that, about Cassidy, about Babs, about the ineffable things, about why... Mountain Girl explodes suddenly. Why, she says, throwing up her hands and shaking her head with such an air of authority and conviction that he is crushed. Later, Kesey comes in and happens to say in the course of something, Cassidy doesn't have to think anymore. Then he walks away. It is as if, for some reason, he is furnishing Norman with part of the puzzle. Kesey keeps doing this kind of thing. As if by radar, Kesey materializes at the critical moment in the cabin, out front, in the back house, up in the woods. The crisis may be somebody's personal thing or some group thing. Suddenly Kesey pops up like Captain, shot over in Shaw's play Heartbreak House, delivers a line, usually something cryptic, allegorical, or merely descriptive, never a pronouncement or a judgment. Half the time he quotes the wisdom of some local sage. Page says, Cassidy says, Babs says. Babs says, if you don't know what the next thing is, all you have to... And just as suddenly he's gone. For example... Well, it always seems like there's no dissension around here, no arguments, no conflict, in spite of all these different and, in some cases, weird personalities ricocheting around and rapping and carrying on. Yet that is only an illusion. It is just that they don't have it out with one another. Instead, they take it to Kesey, all of them forever waiting for Kesey, circling around him. One kid, known as Pancho Pillow, was a ball-breaker freak. He has to break your balls by coming on obnoxious in any way he could dream up. After which you were supposed to reject him, after which he could feel hurt and blame you for all. That was his movie. One night Pancho was in the house with a book about oriental rugs full of beautiful color plates, and he is rapping on and on about the beautiful rugs. Like, man, I mean, these cats were turned on 10 centuries ago, the whole thing. They had mandalas you never dreamed of, right? Look here, man, I want to blow your mind for you just one time. And he sticks the book under some prankster's nose. Here's a beautiful color picture of an Isfahan rug, glowing reds and oranges and golds and star-like vibrating lines all radiating out from a medallion at the center. No thanks, Pancho. I already had some. Come on, man. I mean, like, I gotta share this thing. I gotta make you see it. I can't keep this whole thing to myself. Like, you know, I mean, I want to share it with you. You dig? Now you look at this one. And so on, shoving the goddamn book at everybody, waiting for somebody to tell him to go fuck himself, at which point he can stalk out, fulfilled. Feed the hungry bee, but Christ, this ball breaker is too much.